The Two Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographer Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the Two Stop In. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations. But this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The Two Stop In.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Two Stop In. I'm here today with Clara Chong, who's my creative and business partner, and we're also a husband and wife team.
We are indeed.
Welcome back to the Two Stop In, Clara.
Thanks, Ben.
Now, Blackmagic Design have now released the iPad version of DaVinci Resolve.
Yes, it's very, very exciting.
And we've been lucky enough to have been playing with the beta version of this for the last month. And so we thought it'd be a great opportunity to share some of what we've discovered with you, some of the insights and ideas that we've had.
Exactly. And also, I think there's been a lot of debate about the, not so much the relevancy, but how we, you know, how having Resolve on the iPad is important. And I think what Ben and I have found in the way that we work is that it's actually quite revolutionary for us.
Yeah, it's quite a new thing. Like, I think there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, how is it different to having it on a laptop? You know, did it need to be something different, or is it, but what we've found is it actually does work. It works amazingly well. It's the same application, but the experience of using it on the iPad is very different to using it on a laptop or on a desktop system, obviously.
And certainly, yes, you've got the portability, that's a big factor, but also the fact that it's touchscreen. You can use your Apple Pencil or you can use your speed editor to, you know, push what you want further. And I think those are additional tools, again, to help the modern day filmmaker take advantage of, you know, how to speed up a project, which is always the biggest challenge, I think, in working in this industry.
Now, just to put this into some context for the listeners, Clara, you've been, for most of your kind of nearly 30-year career, you've been editing in some form or another.
Yes, I started way back in Japan with linear editing, tape-to-tape linear editing, and you learn very quickly how to make decisions as an editor, because if you make the wrong decision, you lose half a frame, and you make enough wrong decisions, then you lose a lot more than that. So it's a great way to learn editing, I think, because it makes you, you know, think quickly on your feet and then work out, okay, what exactly do you need to cut together a scene?
And then after that, you experienced cutting and splicing actual film at film school in New York.
Yes, I think it was the last throes of real film editing. So it's an amazing feeling to actually tangibly touch film and then literally splice it together. We used a Moviola and a Steambeck. And those were experiences that I think it's sad that so many of the modern filmmakers now don't get a chance to do, because it's very different knowing that it's that film that you are editing. And I guess, you know, feeling that, touching that makes you appreciate the art of editing in a whole different light.
Something, just listening to you talking about that, something that hadn't occurred to me before, is that there is something tangible about the touchscreen interface.
Yes.
That you are touching the, you know, it's a digital version of the film.
Well, but it's a modern way of doing it, isn't it?
But you are, it's still a more tactile process.
Yes. And I think, you know, what we're doing with, you know, filmmaking is we're trying to connect the audience to what you're showing. And if the editor can actually physically feel like they're a part of that process, even digitally with the touchscreen, I think it just psychologically helps you get into the place where you are connecting. And it's just all those layers, and you don't know exactly what it is that ultimately makes the edit work seamlessly. And, you know, Walter Murch, obviously, in the blink of an eye, he describes it as it's very much a gut feeling, and you've got it's a sense of knowing how it flows and the breathing that an edit develops. And I think it opens up a whole new way of editing by introducing the touchscreen to the editing process.
And I guess anything in the editing process that makes it faster and more intuitive helps with that that thought process and also the execution of the thought process.
Yes. I mean, you know, we were pretty blown away by seeing the new 2022 iPad Pro in action. And I think the fact that there are so many advances with this particular iteration of the iPad. And I so think...
I was just going to say, before we kind of get into all that stuff, since it, like in the 20-something years since you went to film school, you've continued to edit on Avid and on Final Cut Pro, often working with an editor up until about 15 years ago. And since then, you've been hands-on with virtually all of your editing. Can you explain a bit about why it's important for you to actually be hands-on with the editing process?
Well, it evolved because I love working with editors, and I've worked with some very, very good editors. And I think what happens is in between the paid projects, you work on your own projects, and it's the physical hands-on getting to know how to edit. And then I reached a level of competency in editing where suddenly I realized I was pushing buttons and doing things before I actually had the conscious thought.
Before you put it into words.
Exactly. And I realized, oh my God, if I can't even explain it to the editor exactly what I was thinking but I can do it, then I think perhaps I should try and see what it'd be like if I edited my own material. And what I learned is it's a cycle, because if you learn how to edit better, it makes you a better writer, it makes you a better director, better, you know, all down the line within filmmaking, because it's so collaborative. And every element does come down to, what do you shoot? How do you bring the scenes together? And you're always up against something that happens on set where you've got time constraints, the weather changes, all that unpredictability that a set brings. And understanding the tools you have, and as an editor, it's okay, we have only 2 more hours to shoot the rest of the scene. What's the minimum I can get away with, or what are the other ways perhaps I could cut this together to make this work?
Which are the best compromises to make?
Exactly. And I think that's what professional filmmaking is. It's
At
any level, you get better and better at understanding what it is you need to make something work, and you just get better at figuring out other solutions along the way.
Yeah. I think what you've described there with your journey with editing is kind of similar to what I've experienced with color grading, where I love collaborating with a colorist, and I have so many friends who are brilliant colorists, and yet I've gotten to a point where I've done enough color grading that the thoughts connect straight to the muscle memory, and it just happens before you even articulate what's going on. And that's a very satisfying process.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I remember when you first started colour grading on our commercials, and this was back in Melbourne days. And so that's a good, 17 years now that we've been colour grading. And then Yeah, that's true. And then on DaVinci Resolve, our journey there has been at least the last 10 years.
Yeah. And so I think it's still mind-boggling to us, because we remember, I think the last grade we did on a TV commercial in a conventional telecine suite that we shot on film and graded in a DaVinci, one of the big DaVinci rooms with the telecine, would have been 2005. And but it's incredible to see how far it's come in that time. And it's not just that the tools are more accessible, but the really accessible version of it now is vastly more powerful than the, you know, $1-2 million room was back then.
Exactly. And I think because I don't know in the world of filmmaking whether our rates have increased with the rest of the economy. I think a lot of filmmakers, unless you're, you know, up in the echelons, it's difficult to be competitive if you raise your rates too much.
And so you've got to be clever.
Exactly. And you also need to know how to multi-skill. If you need to multi-skill, then you need to understand all the tools you have at your disposal to make something the best it can be. And I think what's beautiful about, you know, understanding the edit process or understanding the colour grading process is you understand also how to work with another colour grader or, you know, in post, you understand the language. And I think that's a key thing that a lot of, I certainly know in my earlier days, it's nerve-wracking because like, oh, how do I explain? Okay, I just want to, you know, bring down the shadows a little bit more. I'm going to move up the mid-tones. You need to understand the terminology of what you're using, a power window, you know, a lower grad, or in editing, just losing a couple of frames, you know, which way do you want to go? Do you want to start it earlier or finish it earlier? Do you want to extend this a shot or you want to replace it? Or just, or, you know, there are so many.
And what's the difference between a couple of frames and six frames?
There's a very big difference.
There's a huge difference when you watch it.
Yeah.
But to know intuitively which way it's more likely to work and go straight to that rather than after several attempts.
Exactly. And how just moving a couple of frames or shifting the start point of a clip can change the emotion of a scene. And I think that's where just practicing, and that's where this DaVinci Resolve is extraordinary for being able to have all of that within the system. And you can learn that by just becoming familiar with trying different things. And even for a beginner, it's a great way of just understanding, okay, what is saturation, what is contrast, what is luminance. It's all of that.
Yeah.
And understanding, even without understanding how to output it to, you know, to go on to the delivery process, just understanding how it all comes together and how it works.
Yeah. And, you know, just to be able to, for anyone, whether it's on the iPad or whatever machine they've got access to be able to get the free version of Resolve and just start experimenting with things, get some footage in there, create a test project. You're not going to break anything. Just see what the controls do and start to get a feel for what's possible. And I think it's one of the wonderful things that Blackmagic has done by making that very powerful free version so accessible that it really is, there's not anything like the barrier that used to be there to learn color grading, to learn editing in a professional way.
And if you look at the modern era now where everything you can Google on YouTube and find, you know, a how-to on something.
Yeah.
But the problem with that side, the other side of the coin of that is there's so much information. It's like, where do you find the one that works for you? And that's where actually the best way is to try it yourself. Find out through personal experience what works, how it does come together and what you're finding trouble with. And then you can troubleshoot that by, you know, then going to those YouTube videos or whatever. But there's also a lot with built in within the system. I think that with, you know, with the how-to help, that is an extraordinary mine of information.
So we've been doing all of our colour grading in Resolve for the last decade. About 2 years ago, we switched our main sound mixing into Resolve in Fairlight, which has been an amazing experience, which we should have another conversation about another time. But this year, we also made the leap of you starting to edit in DaVinci Resolve as well.
Yes.
What was that transition like for you?
Surprisingly smooth. And I say, you know, with a big surprise, because I've shifted from various nonlinear platforms before of with editing.
There was, from my memory, there was usually some swearing involved at various points.
Oh, really?
But it wasn't like that this time, was it?
No. And it's always scary when you do go to a different editing system because, you know, you're fast because you're used to how it works,
you know,
and how it comes together. And I love, you know, my favorite is Final Cut Pro. I have really enjoyed editing with that. But as a director and also co-creative director in a production company, the argument that you could do everything with one system was too great. There were too many pros, too many positives.
The workflow advantages, now that we've taken a few projects right through from you editing on a separate machine usually with proxy files still, but editing in Resolve and then bringing that timeline into the master project. And it is so fast, it's so efficient, and it works so well.
And everything that I cut comes in exactly as I've cut it, with every fade, every
keyframe, every font, everything is exactly as you've left it, the track layouts.
So we don't waste any time in
figuring that stuff out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think, but the other massive pro, I guess, as a director. It's, you know, you're constantly trying to fine-tune something and make it absolutely right. And in the, not even the olden days, it's still happening now, we absolutely have to lock off picture before we can get started on the rest of the finishing process. But because now picture and sound are in the same system, not that you want to, you know, tweak to the nth degree forever, but you can still make changes to the mix as well as the color grade as well as the edit. Yeah. And you know, it's a ripple effect.
Because those three things
are
existing side by side. There's still flow-on effects of making changes,
exactly.
Obviously.
Yeah.
If you change the music, the mix is going to change. There's no way around that. Mm-hmm. But because those three things, the edit, the grade and the mix, are all existing in the same timeline, the power to make changes is expanded extraordinarily.
Exactly. You just have to make decision of, okay, is making this last change worth it?
Yeah.
And at what cost?
Mm.
But the cost is far less, like, you know, dramatically less than what it was when you had picture lock off and you physically had to then hand it over to someone else.
Yeah, because then making edit changes would result in having to redo grade and mix processes in order to get back there.
And I think that's the thing as well, the interrelatedness of the sound mix with the color grade. And because what we found when we were color grading and mixing our feature Dark Noise is when you play with an element in the sound, suddenly the picture feels like it needs to go darker, or, you know, you need to tweak the mood of the picture a little bit more to match what you're doing in the mix. And that was never something that you could do before. It's kind of, you know.
So now we're finding those two processes can bounce off each other as kind of interwoven creative processes, which is what they should be.
Mm. And with our edit suite, we've got, you know, the two XDR monitors that we have side by side. So it's literally our sound and picture right next door to each other.
Yep.
And so whenever, we're doing a mix or a grade, I'm watching the exact image that Ben is mixing or color grading to.
And so I just move back and forth between the color panel and the sound panel. So it's a wonderful, wonderfully freeing creative process.
I think that's the word. It's freedom. It's creative freedom. But you've got the quality control there too. Mm. And I think that's a pretty heady mix.
Yeah. Now, that's running on the Big Mac Pro. The idea of that same software running on an iPad is still just, wild idea.
Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed with a lot of pro applications where they've done, you know, iPad versions of them, is there's been a tendency for them to make sure that it doesn't compete with the desktop version. They'd be stripped down, very basic versions of it often. And so what's happened in a lot of areas is you've got natively built applications for the iPad that have just rocketed ahead beyond these legacy star names. And I think a great example of that is Procreate, which you use a lot.
I do. And I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, in talking about the iPad, it's, you know, the way I use the iPad is a lot with Procreate. So you use the iPencil a lot. And, you know, to be used to the sensitivity of the iPencil to get all the complexity of all the changes that you want, the shading right, the everything, and then to realize that now with DaVinci Resolve on the iPad, you can use that same iPencil.
The Apple Pencil. But the thing about that as well is, like, it's not just that Procreate exists as an iPad application. It wouldn't be the same thing running on a laptop or a desktop computer. It's a lot of its functionality is built around that device and the capacity of that device.
Yes. I think it's extraordinary. It's got, you know, I think that it's.
So just to pick up on that, I think Blackmagic set themselves an extraordinary challenge to bring not just a gimmicky version of something that looks like DaVinci Resolve and is called DaVinci Resolve to the iPad, but to take this application that, you know, some of the core functionality of that has survived since the DaVinci systems of the 1990s. And to take that and make that really work in a touchscreen environment, I think is a really ambitious thing. And so that, I think, gives us a clue about why it's taken so long to get DaVinci Resolve on the iPad, because obviously there's two big issues there. One is it's not their style to just strip it down and put up something gimmicky to say it works.
Yeah.
And B, the hardware needed to get to the point where you could actually do real work.
And be powerful enough to actually, you know, really have the grunt to be able to handle all of this.
Yep.
And I think that's what we were so surprised at, because we've been using the DaVinci Resolve on the iPad for the last month.
Yeah.
And what we found is...
it's very capable.
It's more than capable. And even with HDR, we played around with putting Matt Allard's beautiful imagery of Tokyo in the snow, which is, you know, one of our...
So let's talk through that process, because that's a great example of just how well this works. So that was a test project that Matt Allard shot on the Alexa Mini LF over in Japan. Mm-hmm. I graded in Resolve, in Aces, in HDR, in 4K digital cinema. And it was a complex stylized grade. It wasn't just very, very basic.
And you've got white on white on white with the snow, you've got the mountains and, you know, it just...
The source footage for that is ProRes 4444XQ. So it's the highest level of ProRes, the highest data rate with ProRes out of the Mini LF at 4.5K.
Yeah.
So there's a huge amount of data getting thrown around. And... So just to be able to get that onto the iPad and actually play it off the internal storage is mind-boggling alone. And it's one of the interesting things about the new iPad is that there are some options there with quite a lot of storage. So you could actually conceivably work on projects with the internal storage.
Well, you could have a whole long form. You could have a whole feature and not have anything extraneous hanging off the iPad. It's all within the one iPad.
Certainly if you're using proxy files, you could be doing all of that on like on a 1 or 2 terabyte iPad, which are now available. So that kind of takes it to another level as well. So what I did with this test project was copy all of the media across to an SSD and then onto the iPad's internal storage. And then the project file, and this is one of the other really surprising things, is that the project files are not just compatible, but they are exactly the same project files as the full-blown desktop DaVinci Resolve. So you could be working on the iPad, send that project file to a Mac Pro running Resolve there and work with the big panels, or onto a Linux version, whatever, they're all using exactly the same project files. So once I had that media on the iPad, I just imported that project file and bang, there it is, playing with the full grade
in real time,
in Aces, in 4K, in HDR. And, you know, I was expecting that to show me which shots it fell over on, where it was going to have to do a bit of rendering to cache those. And it just didn't happen. Everything worked real time.
And I think that's what it is about this 2022 model. And, you know, you've got it's the reference mode as well that is a massive game changer. Yeah. Because, you know, to have this kind of reliable, stable color, contrast and brightness.
And I think the thing that helps with thinking about how significant reference mode is, if you think about the traditional way of getting a reference image, it's out through a video output device and SDI, and so you're taking the operating system out of the equation. And effectively, even though it happens within the operating system, effectively reference mode takes the operating system as we know it out of the equation. So all the controls, the options, the variability that's there gets removed.
And to have that exact matching of color across, you know, if you had 5 devices across 5 devices, is an extraordinary level of control that you have. And, you know, filmmakers are already using the iPad to check dailies and things. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a scope to push it a lot further across all the different stages of filmmaking.
Yeah. So the 12.9 inch is the one that we've been using Resolve with. which has got the XDR display, the reference mode, 1600 nits of peak brightness, but it can sustain 1000 nits across the screen, which, again, there's not many displays, even high-end displays, that will consistently display 1000 nits across the screen if they need to.
Yeah, plus the 2500 dimming zones.
Well, see, that's a big deal, the dimming zones, because it's that allows you to get really accurate blacks and shadows in particular areas where there's also brightness nearby. And certainly that on these iPads is working really, really well. Like the contrast is very, very impressive.
And just that consistency. I mean, we know from our road tripping our film how the various cinemas are very different, and it's quite surprising to realise that...
How much variation there is.
There is, yeah. And to know that actually if you have, you know, an iPad Pro, you can guarantee that what you're seeing and hearing, we're not even, you know, talking about the spatial audio aspect of it yet.
Which is something else we should probably come back to as well. But the whole thing of you can have different people in different places, and if they're looking at one of these iPads each and they've got it in reference mode, they are going to see exactly the same picture. And that's such a big breakthrough. And to know that, you know, it's this person's not going to have their brightness up and that person have their brightness down. If they're looking at it in reference mode, they're going to see the same thing.
Which is huge because, yes, iPads have been used before in terms of checking, you know, for a client to check content.
Yep.
But to know now that you can actually be color grading remotely and have it exact on the screen as you're doing it, I mean, there's no error there. It is exact. And that is a huge breakthrough.
Yeah. The other thing about it, of course, is ProMotion, which... You know, it's one of those things that is designed for one purpose, but actually for us provides something different. And so the ProMotion was designed as a way of allowing it to go up to very high frame rates for things like games and so on, and then drop down to very low frame rates to save battery power.
Yep.
But what it means for us in the film industry, things like 24p, we see at 24p on a digital display exactly.
Yep.
Which is wonderful. And so that's another huge advantage of this just as a display technology.
Yeah. But then you've got the hardware encoding and decoding for ProRes, H.264 and H.265.
This is a big deal because that takes a lot of workload off the CPU. And so that frees it up to do other stuff. And I think that's one of the reasons why some of this high-res test footage has worked so well, because the hardware encoding and decoding is actually speeding up that process of dealing with these massive ProRes files. And so it's doing that, allowing the CPU and GPU to get on with the creative work, which is this kind of amazing divide and conquer thing that's going on.
Well, that's also bringing us to the M2 processor.
Yeah, so the whole journey that Apple's on to move to their own chip designs is I find it quite an interesting one as well. Because when they first announced it was like, well, why go down that path? But of course, they'd already been doing it for quite a while with their iPhones and iPads, that they, to make them work the way they wanted to have the features that they wanted to be able to sell, they had to design their own chips. And a lot of that was around heat management and power demands. So, yeah. Clearly they've realized that they've been able to push things further by doing that. And then they've made this decision we're going to switch the Mac ecosystem across to Apple Silicon as well.
And it's increasing how much it's been sped up by sharing the memory between the CPU and the GPU.
Well, that's, I think, something that's quite often overlooked, because traditionally, you've got a situation where you've got some compressed raw footage and the CPU is decoding and debayering that, and then it's got to move that from the CPU's memory to the GPU's video memory in order for the GPU to then do whatever color effects you're doing on that. And then it's got to move back to the CPU to then render out. And so that's you know, it's happening very, very fast, but it's still extra processes that have to happen, you know, billions of times a second if you're talking about high-res material.
Mm.
And so the fact that the Apple Silicon gets around that by letting the GPU and the CPU access the same pool of memory means that the frames can be loaded in, debayered, decompressed, and then the GPU can process them without having to shuffle it back and forth between the different memory systems. So all this streamlining means that there's a lot of advantages happening before you even get to using any of the power of the CPU and the GPU.
Yeah. But I think it's important also to realize, yes, this is the power in the processing, but what makes it exciting is how it makes everything more workable for us.
Yeah, and I think the speed that things happen at, again, is such an important part of, you know, if you had editing and grading on an iPad with professional level tools, but you had to render everything in order to play it back, you know, 10 years ago that would have been mind-blowing. But these days I think people are used to being able to do this creative work, play it back straight away, assess it and make changes instantly. And so the fact that you can not only have these tools available on a touchscreen tablet device, but that it works that smoothly is a big part of what makes it relevant at this point in time.
Because, yeah, I mean, when you're working in moving picture, they are massive files, and so speed is everything because you want to keep that creative flow going and being able to keep cutting and not have to wait for things to render, for things to process.
Yep.
But you take it for granted, I think, how quickly it works on the iPad, because it doesn't seem to be working very hard at all. And yet...
Well, that's the other thing that blew my mind with loading up this the Japanese mountains footage. That, you know, there's a full grade going on with secondaries and power windows and ACES and HDR and all that stuff. Opened up the project, it looks exactly the same as it did on the XDR monitors, and it's playing real time. But the difference is it's on this little tiny device. There's no fan noise. There's no heat building up. You know, it's that I do not understand how that's working, that they've been able to leverage this technology to the point where they can do that amount of processing and not be generating mountains of heat.
I mean, you know, we can backtrack to 2020 when we were shooting Dark Noise and our data management system was so removed from where we're at even now. It's, you know, less than 3 years later.
So, yeah, our processing of dailies and proxies for editorial was a MacBook Pro hooked up to a Blackmagic eGPU. And that was really – that got us a good result and a workable speed. But it's amazing to see how far that's come, you know, from those Intel MacBook Pros to now the Apple Silicon – and just how big a leap that's turned out to be.
But it has implications across the board. That's the thing. It's not, I mean, having it on the iPad, the mobility, it then opens up so many more ways to be able to use the iPad. Because, traditionally an editor is not on set. You know, the odd big picture, you maybe have the editor there helping cut together things. But even for a small indie film, you know, what I was doing with Dark Noise was at the end of the day, I'd be looking at the rushes and then just working out, okay, cutting something together just as a rough edit, just to work out, okay, what's missing? Do I need to have anything else? What else do we need to shoot tomorrow so I can preempt any holes that we have in the sequence of scenes? But if you were there on set with the iPad,
you could throw a few shots together and just go, oh, yep, that works. Or, oh, we need another close-up of
when you're right there with the actors on location. Yep. And
I think what's different about the iPad, because you could do all that with a laptop. You could have an editor on set with a laptop. You as director could have your laptop there.
Yeah, but it's the speed.
And it's also the ergonomics of it, because to do that kind of editing with a laptop, you really kind of need peripheral devices like a Wacom tablet and those kind of things to make it ergonomic. Whereas working with the Apple Pencil straight onto the iPad, you've got the reference display there. You've got the control of it directly onto the screen itself. And it would actually be quite workable that if you wanted to, say, if you were the editor on something, and or for that matter, the colorist, and you wanted to pop down to set and try a couple of things out, show the director, show the cinematographer, then you could do that on the iPad. You could move your, like, copy a sequence across to the iPad and then walk down to set with the iPad and go, okay, what do you think about this? We'll make a couple of changes here. And, you know, that's very doable on a small picture, on a big picture, in a way that is different to setting up a laptop on a desk on set.
I mean, we were talking about this earlier where you can also create LUTs now on the iPad. So if you could create the LUTs and you have a couple of different variations, and what if something did change on set where the weather was just not conducive to getting the exact look you wanted, you could immediately tweak it and say, okay, this is what we can do and get sign-off immediately.
I mean, even the idea of sitting in a pre-production meeting with director and colorist and cinematographer looking at the iPad and creating variations of a look, and not just as a reference but the actual look there, and exporting those LUTs that can be used in cameras and monitors, used for editorial, and to be able to do that as a collaborative process just on this portable device, again, it's pretty wild.
It really is, because I think that...
And technically very doable.
I think the technology has been there for a while across a lot of different areas, but, and, you know, filmmakers do have a lot of tools, and I think that's already shaken up the traditional pre-production, production, post, you know, system of filmmaking. And a lot of filmmakers, including ourselves, are often mixing and matching. There is so much we do in pre-production or even in the ID stage. You think about, you know, and what the iPad opens up is so much more processing power. So I'm thinking even, okay, you've got the animatics or the visual, the VFX work. I mean, we saw also how you can use the VFX tool.
Yeah, Octane renderers.
And that was working real time.
Yeah. Which, again, is, you know, we're talking render farm kind of stuff very recently. And so it's another option, I think, for different ways of working. And so things that used to be tied to a room full of gear that you can now do on this device and do that in different contexts. I mean, obviously, ambient light would still be an issue if you're talking about color stuff. But it's doable. You could be doing this stuff in a hotel room or, you know, creating looks in a meeting room if you just do a little bit of effort around controlling the ambient light.
I mean, that's the thing. Between COVID and just the way these tools are accessible, mobility is a massive issue for filmmakers. So we can travel. I mean, we travel with hard drives, but if we now have an iPad that... If, you know, money was no object, you could create it per project. And but it's also the affordability factor of, okay, if you are trying to make a decision between getting a, you know, a laptop, and you now have the option of working it on an iPad where you also have the reference mode and you have that processing power, I think it becomes a very real option for a filmmaker to go, okay, I can do this now. And you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is the beginning, not the end. And the
I think for a lot of cinematographers and directors, for example, they may not actually need a laptop anymore. That, you know, a lot of what they need to do can be done on an iPad, and bringing these tools on there as well means that you're not going, okay, well, I really want an iPad for reading scripts and, doing emails and all that sort of stuff that's very portable. But then you've also, you can be checking rushes, you can be creating looks, you can be sending ideas for grades back and forth.
And also presenting a finished project to a client. The sound is amazing. And, you know, you've got your magic
keyboard.
I'm losing all the terminology in my head at the moment, end of year sort of thing. But it is, you know, there are so much scope to, it's just a matter of, you know, how filmmakers choose to use the new tools that we have and figuring out how the iPad best works for them.
Yeah. And I think there will be other people that will look at it on the iPad and go, okay, that's not for me. That's just not the way I want to work. And the beautiful thing, though, is having those choices. You know, if you want to be only working on Linux on a desktop machine that you've built yourself, great, go for it, do it. But for a lot of people in the industry, I think having these tools on the iPad and having the amount of power that's there just opens up a lot of possibilities.
Yeah. I mean, we had an example just, you know, a couple of weeks ago. I threw my back out too much editing.
Yeah.
But what was amazing was because we had the DaVinci Resolve on the iPad.
Started off with we moved the project that we had a deadline on onto the iPad, and you started editing on there.
Yeah. You know, flat on my back. I couldn't move. So I could, you know, my arms I could move. So I actually had to get Ben in this case to push buttons for me.
Yep. So we then moved that project from the iPad as it is, media and project file, onto my laptop. But then I was pushing the buttons for you. The marriage survived. But I was pushing the buttons with your directions and then feeding that image wirelessly using Sidecar to the iPad Pro screen so that you could be watching the edit in real time as I was doing it without even having to sit up in bed, which you couldn't do at that stage. So,
but even before that, you know, we had the speed editor on, connected to the iPad, and I was able to just literally bring together the structure roughly of the edit I wanted. I mean, that's where the speed editor and the cut page works beautifully on the iPad to be able to just get the beginning parts of the edit on the timeline.
Yeah, yeah. And that's probably worth spending a little bit of time talking about the cut page. So for those who aren't kind of aware of it or aren't fully kind of across it, so a couple of years ago, Blackmagic introduced the cut page alongside the edit page. And the edit page had been evolving for a while from a pretty basic kind of conform tool in years gone by to quite a powerful nonlinear editor in its own right. And then they introduced the cut page to be a different style of editing environment where it's all designed around speed and flexibility. And so it's kind of like it's almost like the edit page is a big tape-to-tape online suite from years gone by. The cut page is a little tape-to-tape offline editing suite.
Yeah. So you can see, like, you know, where the cut page would be amazing would be for really time-sensitive material like news or current affairs.
Yep. News, current affairs, fast turnaround corporate work, all those sort of things that you could in the cut page. And quite a few episodes of the T-Stop In have been edited in the cut page. And I've done a couple of episodes on the cut page on an aeroplane traveling between different places. And it's very workable. One thing I was thinking about recently is actually using the iPad and the touchscreen interface on an aeroplane. It would be much more manageable than having a 16-inch laptop there on the plane, the tray table.
Oh, yeah.
So even just little stuff like that about the ergonomics of it, it is quite different. On the computer versions, the Mac, Windows and Linux versions, you've got the choice between the cut page and the edit page, and timeline exists simultaneously in both of those. You can go back and forth, in fact, which I do quite a bit. Go back and forth between the cut page and the edit page because there's things that are faster and easier in both of them. I know you, Clara, mostly use the edit page at the moment.
Yes.
And I think that's probably, even though you've used Final Cut Pro 10 a lot, I think your grounding in Avid editing probably makes you more comfortable with that more traditional nonlinear.
Probably. It's more sort of intuitive.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the learning curve from Final Cut Pro to Resolve wasn't as daunting as I expected it to be.
Yeah.
In fact, it was, I don't think it really cost us any time
No.
on the project that we ended up,
the first
testing
one
this on, yeah. Yeah. And you can never have a test project. It's got to be a real project, yeah. And so that's inherently nerve wracking doing that. But we chose one because it was, you know, it was a shorter project, and so it was more contained, and it would be our footage, so we knew that, you know, we'd be able to follow it, you know, from start
right
to finish.
Through.
Yeah.
So on the iPad, though, there is only the cut page. There isn't the edit page. And I believe that decision was based on the fact that the cut page has been designed with the touchscreen interface in mind. And to make that work on the edit page was going to be a whole different process. So,
but I think that's where you need to plan out how you're going to use it best. And I think it's the mobility of being able to even start a project. I mean, you know, both a documentary or drama work, the cut page, from what, you know, we've played around with, is most helpful in getting it started quickly.
Yep.
And then you're able to transfer back and forth from, you know, your full edit system.
The other thing, of course, is that the cut page on the iPad with the touchscreen interface is a completely different experience to the cut page on a laptop or a desktop.
Yes.
It's such a different beast. And so I think the cut page really starts to come into its own a bit more on the iPad.
Well, it seems to be the same interface, but it's adapted.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that's one of the other really clever things that they've done with this and with taking their time to bring Resolve to the iPad in the right way at the right time, is that as soon as you open it up, it is recognizably DaVinci Resolve. It's the same app. And so the learning curve is almost non-existent if you're really familiar with Resolve already. And, you know, I was up and running in the color page in seconds. And things like the, you know, right-click behavior. So if you want to grab a still, if you want to export a LUT, all of that is so intuitive. You know, I don't even know if there is a manual for Resolve on the iPad.
We haven't looked for it actually. So
we haven't needed it, is the thing, I guess.
And I think where we've been most excited perhaps is knowing that you can have finished projects anywhere and you can still just put that project back into the iPad and just adjust if you have to. It means that, you know, all those final changes that you get from clients that you know are not final changes, but, you know, within a certain period of time that you can still tweak that very easily.
Yeah. And you can, because it's USB-C, you can plug in an external hard drive. So if you had a smaller storage capacity on the system storage, or just had a project that you weren't expecting to have to load on, you just plug in an external drive, particularly an SSD. And so I could imagine scenarios where we would, say, finish a project on the Mac Pro and then go, okay, we think the client's happy with it, but we need to get on a plane tomorrow, and so we're going to have a copy of that project on an SSD with the iPad. If the client called you up at the airport and said, I just need this one thing changed.
And you know they always do.
And it would just be a matter of opening up the iPad, plugging in that hard drive, opening up the project, making the change, exporting it, uploading it, and you're done.
Yep.
And that's pretty wild.
But it's also it's that touch screen with the color grading and the ability to adjust.
Yeah.
I think that has been a real game changer for us.
Yeah. So the thought that's gone into how those controls behave, not just where they are and what they do, but things like the fact that the controls don't behave in a linear way. So if you think about the size of the color wheels on the display, if you grabbed the dot that's where your balance is sitting and dragged that even a small distance, that would be a big adjustment. And so what they've done is you grab the color wheel and you move it in the direction that you want, but the movement of your finger or Apple Pencil across the screen is much bigger than what the adjustment is of the movement of that little dot. So which sounds kind of weird, but actually, they've got the balance of that right so that it feels right. And so it's one of those weird things where the literal logical
correct thing feels wrong. And they've made it wrong in a way that feels right. And that's across all the controls.
Exactly. But that is the big difference between being able to do that on the iPad versus on the laptop.
Yeah. And so being able to actually touch those controls, see it intuitively and not trying to find your way with a trackpad. And, you know, I'm a really big fan of hardware control surfaces, both for sound and for colour, and also for editing. And so the idea of editing or doing grading with a trackpad or a mouse, I find very, very frustrating. You can do it, but I just find it slow and laborious compared to being able to just grab the controls and move it directly. The touchscreen interface is a whole different thing again, because you can still look at the controls and go grab that, move that a bit and that. And so it's a whole other thing unto itself, and it really works surprisingly well.
I think you're probably just waiting for the audio side of things now.
Oh, God. yeah, because so the other clever thing that they've done is instead of getting all of the pages half operational, they've gone, okay, we're going to do the cut page and the colour page, get those right, and then expand out from there. They haven't said exactly what that roadmap is. Hopefully that'll include Fusion at some point, because
and
I think
Fairlight.
Visual effects on the touchscreen interface would be amazing. But Fairlight on that interface, if they can do with the Fairlight interface the kind of stuff they've done, the intuitive interaction they've done with the colour on the edit pages, the cut page, sorry, if they can do that with the Fairlight page, that's going to be phenomenally powerful. And we know all the processing is already there. It's just the user interface that's missing. So if the Fairlight page is coming in a future version, I think that will take the whole system to a completely different level in terms of being able to actually deliver really polished work very quickly without any other system or hardware involved.
And, you know, this is just a start, isn't it, by having the colour and sound on the same system. Just the sheer time factor, but the efficiency with how you can move back and forth from them. It's a simultaneous process now. It's no longer a, okay, you picture lock off, then you
we're
start.
We're doing the grade on this day and or on these dates, and we're doing the mix on those dates. And, you know, once you've had that creative experience of being able to go, oh, this we're doing this with the EQ and it makes this feel darker, we want to actually darken off the pictures, and you just do it and they bounce off each other and snowball
creatively. Yeah, or the reverse
creatively.
Of that, you know. It's like we were just playing even with Matt Allard's footage and just seeing how far you could push it and how real time each change was. And you know intuitively just the sheer complexity of all the factors that should make that impossible.
Yeah.
And yet we were seeing with our, you know, with our eyes just right in front of us that it was completely real time.
Yep. And I wasn't able to break it with like break the real time with that project. And again, 4.5K ProRes XQ, DCI Cinema 4K, Acer's HDR, complex grade, and then adding stuff deliberately to the grade to make it more complex and more difficult. And I'm going to keep trying, but I haven't actually made it get to the point where it couldn't do real time yet.
Yeah.
So it's pretty crazy stuff. Yep. For the editing side of things, I love the speed editor with the iPad Pro. Like just ergonomically, that they're basically the same width, the 12.9 inch iPad Pro and the speed editor. And so you could easily throw the two of them in a backpack or carry them by hand together and then in seconds be up and running, especially with AirPods or some other headphones. You could be up and running and editing and grading anywhere in no time at all. But you're more of a fan of the Apple Pencil for the editing.
Well, again, it's what you're used to, and
because you've been editing with a Wacom tablet for, God, more than 10 years now.
I can't remember a time before it now. So yeah. I know there was, but you blank
we're
out these things.
Like Final Cut 5 or something.
Yeah, but I think that's what's beautiful with, you know, with drama editing. You know, to be able to check back on scenes really quickly. I mean, this is what I can see as very real possibilities now in editing with the iPad. And, you know, so we could, you know, when you're away on location, you don't need the full edit setup to be productive. You can move timelines back to the main edit suite, you know, to finesse.
Yep.
And, but it's a perfect system just to view and even prepare dailies. So there's just so much scope.
Well, to take another example that I can think of that I'm sure will happen on projects where you've got a visually complex scene and a cinematographer who's up to speed with these tools could go to the DIT and say, okay, can you give me a representative shot, an example take of each of the shots in this sequence? The cinematographer back in their hotel room at that night or at lunch can throw those onto a timeline and just do some quick experiments with the look that they want for that sequence that's visually different to the other stuff, and then just email those files, the stills files of those grades to the dailies colorist.
Mm.
And so it could be that simple to be able to go, this is what I want for this scene, and not just a reference, but here's the actual changes that I made.
You can go one step further with that as well. And it's like if you, you know, when you can output the still frame of every scene in a project, you can see the flow of how the light's moving and you can adjust and immediately adjust and just go, actually, no, I want to make that colder. I want to make that, you know, more, you know, historical feeling or whatever it is that you want to do.
Yeah.
But there's so much scope to play and you're playing right there in real time. And so the decisions can be made very, very quickly.
One of the other things you said about editing, that it's made you a better director to edit your own stuff. And I've definitely found that with color grading as well, that I've learned, I think, in a lot of ways more about cinematography by grading my own pictures than I have on set. Because once you get to a certain level of competence with it, you're talking about finer points that you can really pick up when you're analysing what you've done. And so that's
but
where...
But it's not only the editor or the colorist though. I mean, that's the thing with, you know, having this on the iPad that is so mobile and so quick.
Mm.
It you know, whether you're a producer or a production designer or anything along, it's so collaborative. You need everyone to be on the same page when you're making a film. And to be able to do that and show people and make decisions, I think that is going to be the key to making things so much quicker, because the other side of things is if you do have an editor on set and able to quickly cut while you're on location and being able to know while the actors are in costume ready to go again, what else do we need? That's going to save so many thousands, millions of dollars in, you know, pickups and, ADR, whatever, you know, all those post.
Yeah.
Processes.
So, to take another example also from the cinematography point of view, so for a cinematographer, maybe not even influencing dailies or rushes or editorial directly, but just for their own peace of mind, if you could imagine being able to, I mean, there's nothing revolutionary anymore about having dailies on an iPad, but imagine if those weren't just rendered dailies, but you know, ProRes proxies, which are still 10-bit, that you could then open up in Resolve and go, okay, so I know this scene was a bit bright and I'm intending to pull it back. How's it going to look when I pull it back? To be able to actually try stuff and go, yes, that's working, or I might have gone too far there, I'll pull it back for next time. To be able to do those things, not just as a conversation with a colorist, a dailies colorist, but to actually hands-on have the footage there and be able to make adjustments. And we're talking about really simple stuff to learn in Resolve once you're into that ecosystem, to be able to grab the printer lights and bring it down a couple of stops and see how that looks. I think there's a lot of cinematographers would sleep a lot better at night after difficult scenes to be able to do that. I know certainly on Dark Noise, where I was controlling the rushes and the proxies going to editorial out on location, that it certainly did make me sleep better to be able to go, oh, yeah, that I know that I needed to have the exposures a bit hotter on that so that it played out later in the shot. and can bring it back and put a dynamic in. Yep, that's all fine. Mm. It's all good.
I mean, you know, it's interesting because so much of what we're hearing, there's a big skills shortage of – there's a lot of new people entering the industry, which there always should be, but it's that skill level to understand, okay, you know, there's that famous saying, fix it in post, which we know is absolutely not not possible most of the time unless you have all the studio dollars to back it up. Mm. But it's – imagine if we actually had some training – you know, using Resolve and using the iPads for people who are starting just to understand what you can and can't do and what, you know, what the costs involved or, you know, the complexities involved of doing that. If people had more of an understanding, you know, so there'd be ripple effect right down the line so that, you know, people would be on the same page. I think that's the hardest thing when someone's too inexperienced and but they're too scared to say anything, you know, for fear of looking too inexperienced.
Yeah.
Where, as you know, but the thing is that technology now allows you to actually get that experience to be able to do things.
Yep. And which then makes it possible for people to communicate much more effectively about all this stuff. Mm. And I think it's really, there's going to be huge advantages to having, you know, this generation coming through where I hope a lot of cinematographers, I know there are cinematographers and directors who are starting to get familiar with these tools, and I hope a lot of them do, because if you've got the familiarity, like the analogy that I like to use is that cinematographers may not choose to do their own focus. Most cinematographers will choose not to do their own focus, but they know how it works. They know how depth of field works. They know how the lens works. And I think colour for cinematographers should be in the same category. It's just that the tools used to be so inaccessible to start to develop those skills.
Mm.
And now they're not, where you can have the same iPad that you're reading your scripts on. You can be actually playing around with your images and learning what the controls do and how far you can push things.
I think that's the biggest thing, isn't it? I think just understanding what you can do and not being afraid of the technology, making the technology work for you, because it is just another tool for you to do it better, do it quicker, do it cheaper.
And I think that's a really good point, that these are all just tools for the creative process, and that, you know, the fundamentals of filmmaking don't change. The craft of cinematography doesn't change. The craft of directing or editing or colour doesn't change. Just how much is possible and how, what you're able to do with different levels of resources opens up enormously.
It does. And I think there's a whole world out there that this new iPad Pro has also opened up. And I think that's where it's very exciting to think about, you know, how far filmmakers will push it, how far we'll push it.
Yeah, it's because this is really just scratching the surface of what's possible now. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see where new filmmakers, experienced filmmakers and the whole spectrum in between takes this kind of technology in the next few years.
Absolutely.
Clara, thanks for stopping in.
Thanks, Ben.